main agenda of the government.
And is there any way in which this decision might play into Israel's handling of the war in Gaza?
Well, the Israeli government now, we hear officials, they're not very happy with this ruling, but they suggest that they're not going to do anything further to overhaul the judiciary while the country is at war. They recognize it's too divisive of an issue at this time of war, but it does add fuel to what we are hearing as a growing discontent in Israel about the war, about the government's role in this catastrophic situation that Israel's facing. Israeli defense officials in the months leading up to the war had warned publicly that Israel's regional enemies saw how the country was torn apart over this judicial overhaul debate, and that enemies were identifying this as a moment of weakness to attack Israel. And indeed, Hamas attacked on October 7th. The military spokesman yesterday said that was likely one of the reasons Hamas chose this moment to attack. And there are also implications, Michelle, about the day after the war. Analysts say that the government, you hear officials in the government talking about all kinds of policy proposals for what they want to see in Gaza, things that the Supreme Court might determine to be unreasonable. And now that they've overturned this law, they will be able to weigh in.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now let's report on that New Year's Day earthquake in Japan. It was a magnitude 7.6 quake along Japan's western coast, and the death toll is up to at least 48. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
The quake struck Monday shortly before dusk. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said police, firefighters, and military personnel worked through the night to rescue residents trapped in collapsed buildings. Saving disaster victims' lives is a race against time, he told reporters before chairing an emergency government meeting. As Tuesday dawned, Japanese media helicopters flew over Wajima, a city near the quake's epicenter in Ishikawa Prefecture on the country's west coast. A swath of mostly wooden homes in a centuries-old market area could be seen from the air, still smoldering after burning through the night. Residents began to head home from evacuation centers in the morning as teams worked to restore damaged utilities and transportation infrastructure. Prime Minister Kishida said getting responders and equipment into areas near the epicenter was difficult. Many people are working tirelessly to secure routes to deliver heavy machinery, he said. They're working hard to clear broken roads and checking port safety to establish sea transport routes. Japan's government lifted tsunami warnings for most of the country's west coast. They were the first such warnings since a magnitude 9 quake hit Japan's east coast in 2011, killing nearly 20,000 people and triggering a nuclear disaster. Several nuclear plants near Monday's quake's epicenter were inspected, but nothing abnormal was found. It's not clear whether this quake reveals anything about bigger quakes that experts believe could hit Japan in the coming decades. But seismic activity continues to rattle the area near the epicenter, with over 100 aftershocks so far. Prime Minister Kishida said residents need to watch out for magnitude 7 or bigger aftershocks in the coming days. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
It's a new year, but a familiar fight is returning to Washington. The White House will resume talks with congressional Republicans on funding Ukraine's war effort, and there are signs that the White House may need to give up some political ground to get it, specifically on immigration. GOP lawmakers are proposing a tougher standard for asylum claims. Earlier, our co-host A. Martinez spoke to Kenji Kizuka about this. He is the director of asylum policy for the International Rescue Committee. Kizuka started by explaining what happens under the current process.
Once an asylum seeker has told an officer they want to seek asylum, the officer can choose to do a couple of things. They could let that person go on to immigration court and present their asylum claim to a judge, or they might put them in what's called expedited removal, which is a kind of fast-track deportation. And if they are placed in that fast-track deportation, they're going to have to speak to an asylum officer to show that they have a strong chance that they're eligible for asylum in order to stay in the country and to be able to continue the asylum process.
What qualifies them to think that they can qualify for asylum?
So asylum isn't for everyone. It doesn't apply to every kind of issue that might push someone to leave their country. It's a form of protection for people who fear persecution based on their race, their religion, their ethnicity, because of their political opinions, or because they're part of a group that's being persecuted, like based on their sexual orientation or gender.
Okay, so now Senate Republicans are trying to change the standard, and they want asylum requests to go from a significant possibility of persecution to more likely than not. What's the difference between those two?
So the current standard is called credible fear, and that means that a person has a significant possibility or a good chance to show that if they went to immigration court, they would be able to prove that they were eligible for asylum. The proposals that we're seeing in Congress would raise that standard and essentially require people to prove their entire asylum case in the initial screening interview. So the process of these initial screenings that were meant to ensure that people are not returned to danger would, in essence, flip and become the whole game that you have to show and prove your whole case in that initial screening instead of it being a gateway to the rest of the process.
To have to prove everything, as you said, the whole game right there on the spot, it seems like that's an almost impossible standard to meet.
For many people, the screening interview is already really difficult. You're sitting in a little booth in a detention center talking to an officer on the other side of the country over the phone. There's an interpreter on the phone. You're not seeing anyone face to face to be able to explain what happened to you. And you're talking about the worst things that ever happened to you in your life, having to share that you were raped or tortured, having to talk about parts of your identity that were causing you to be persecuted, that you were practicing your faith in secret, or that you were being persecuted because of your sexual orientation. And so these interviews were already so high stakes and so emotionally difficult for people. Imagine on top of that, knowing that now in this interview, you basically have to prove your whole case right there, right on the spot, as soon as you arrive. The kind of pressure that puts on someone who's already been through so much is really hard to imagine.
Should it be a higher standard than what's already in place to be granted asylum to the United States?
The issue that Congress is really grappling with here is that they want to see fewer people arrive at the southern border. And that's not an issue about the asylum standard. The thought that changing this credible fear standard would see fewer people arrive to the United States is a mistake. It's not going to happen. When people's lives are on the line, they're going to flee and they're going to seek any opportunity that might save themselves and their family. And so these changes we're seeing proposed to the asylum standard aren't going to address the humanitarian issues we're seeing at the border, but they will result in people who have genuine fears of persecution being returned to the place where they're in danger.
Kenji Kizuka with the International Rescue Committee. Kenji, thank you very much for explaining all this.
Thanks so much for having me.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, come on a journey to the National Music Museum. There you can track musical history from the world's oldest cello to one of Elvis's guitars. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. Happy to have you along with us on the 2nd of January. It is, of course, 8:19 on this Tuesday. Still to come on the program, you know, there have been some security threats all across Europe as the war in Ukraine drags on. We'll talk about it with the director of the Europe Program for Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
More than 50,000 individuals and families donated to WPR this past year. Thank you. Your generosity delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music to people all over Wisconsin. Your support truly makes a difference, enhancing lives with quality information and entertainment every day.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering a group called Great Decisions. This group is part of America's largest discussion program on world affairs. For more information, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, mostly calm and cool across the state today. Mix of sunshine and clouds and high temperatures in the 20s and 30s. Also a chance for some afternoon flurries in the northern part of the state. Those light flurries in the north could continue into tomorrow. Things will clear up by the afternoon. Still dry across the rest of the state with highs in the 20s and 30s once again. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing stories to illuminate data and trends that shape the world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Any unnatural death in a federal prison requires investigation. I mean, like a homicide or a suicide or an accident. But most deaths in federal prisons are classified as natural deaths, which often means less scrutiny, leaving inmates' families with questions. NPR's Tirza Christopher reports.
When Kesha Jackson first heard that something was wrong with her husband, John, she called Forest City Federal Prison, where he was housed.
The phone just rang, or it kept going to busy.
6 hours later, she still had no answers. Jackson started getting calls from other inmates.
What the prisoners were saying to me is that he had been in a special housing unit for 3 days, banging on the door because he was going in and out of consciousness and he couldn't breathe. And then when the officer came in, he dragged John out into the hallway and tried to give him CPR.
John Jackson was pronounced dead soon after. The medical examiner ruled it a natural death.
When his medical records came home after he passed away, I saw that it was MRSA.
MRSA is a staph infection caused by a type of dangerous drug-resistant bacteria, but it is treatable. John had contracted it after he was moved to the Forest City Federal Prison in 2017. According to his medical records, he still had the infection over 2 years later.
Saying that it's a natural death could sometimes be misleading. I believe that having proper medical treatment could have possibly saved his life.
Previous reporting by NPR exposed inadequate healthcare in federal prisons around the country. According to Bureau of Prison Records we obtained, almost 3/4 of all federal prison deaths have been pronounced natural since 2009. The CDC says natural deaths happen either solely or almost entirely because of disease or old age. But 70% of the inmates who died in federal prison were under the age of 65. After speaking to some of the families of these inmates, NPR found that issues such as medical neglect, poor prison conditions, and a lack of resources were swept under the rug. Meanwhile, family members were left with little information about their loved one's death.
The prison doesn't have to contact family members unless it's a matter of life and death. Well, he's dead. So where was the contact? What I'm getting now? I should have been contacted as soon as there was an incident.
Homer Venters is a federal court monitor of jail and prison health care. He calls deaths like Jackson's jail attributable.
Things that happened behind bars significantly contributed to the outcome of death. despite the fact that a medical examiner ultimately says it was a natural cause of death.
He says that calling a death natural often does not provide the full picture.
So we have this very old, antiquated idea that the coroner, medical examiner, when they say a death was from natural causes, that that should somehow determine whether or not people got what they needed behind bars.
We found issues at prisons around the country. For instance, an inmate in the Springfield, Missouri Medical Center waited weeks to be treated for bleeding in his digestive tract. He died soon after hospitalization. An inmate in Arkansas complained of stomach pain for a year and a half before his death. His family was not provided with any more details. Another inmate in Missouri died of respiratory failure, and his death was pronounced natural. But according to medical examiner records obtained by NPR, his death was later treated as a homicide. But the family was not provided that information and got his autopsy 5 years later. The BOP is not required to conduct autopsies for natural deaths. But there is something called a mortality review that's done every time an inmate dies. These reviews are supposed to be a reflection of, one, how the death was handled, and two, if it was preventable. This information, however, is not shared with the public or even the families.
His roommate contacted me on Facebook on that Sunday morning and said he had collapsed.
That's Celia Wilson. Her brother Lenny had been serving time in the same federal prison as John Jackson. He was on his morning run when he fell over.
We didn't hear from BOP until Tuesday.
The prison case manager told Wilson there was nothing to worry about. Her brother's lawyer, Allison Guernsey, found different information in her brother's medical records.
Celia'd say they think that there are signs of life and maybe vitals are getting better. And then we would ask for those medical records, and they wouldn't actually say that.
Guernsey is a clinical professor and attorney at the University of Iowa Law Clinic. She had to file public records requests every day for updates on Lenny Wilson's health after the collapse.
It was quite difficult to get someone from the Bureau of Prisons to actually tell us what was going on.
2 weeks after his collapse, Celia Wilson's brother died. His death was pronounced natural. But the family had no explanation for why an otherwise healthy 61-year-old man just fell over and died. Her brother's cellmate claimed that he had not received help for almost 10 minutes after his collapse. Since his death in June, the family still has not received the mortality review. Here's Homer Venters again.
We have left healthcare and decisions about what's adequate healthcare to security people. The party line right now is that all the natural causes deaths are unavoidable, and we know that to be simply untrue.
The BOP declined NPR's request for an interview, but said that all deaths are investigated thoroughly. NPR also requested mortality review reports for every inmate who died in BOP custody since 2009, but has yet to receive them. Family members like Celia Wilson still want answers.
It makes no sense to me, which is why it's so frustrating. There is so much they could have done. It's unfathomable.
Tirza Christopher, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Austin, Texas is among dozens of American cities to eliminate parking spot minimums, hoping that less parking will encourage public transportation and make housing more affordable, but not everyone's on board.
Austin has developed as a low-density city without adequate mass transportation system. Austin citizens cannot give up their cars.
That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30, today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Glad you're with us for Morning Edition on this Tuesday, the 2nd of January, for Morning Edition on WPR. News from NPR and WPR starts next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. One of two airports serving the Japanese capital, Tokyo, closed all of its runways after a passenger jet caught fire on the runway. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports an investigation is underway.
Japan Airlines says all 379 passengers and crew made it off the plane before it was engulfed by flames on the runway at Haneda Airport. The JAL flight collided with a Coast Guard plane, which was carrying relief supplies for victims of an earthquake that struck off the country's west coast on Monday. State broadcaster NHK reports that five crew members aboard the Coast Guard plane were killed, and the plane's pilot is in critical condition.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn. Israel says it's temporarily withdrawing thousands of troops from Gaza. The move comes amid mounting pressure from the Biden administration for a more targeted campaign. Dennis Ross is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
All along, I think the Israelis have been listening to the United States, but I think they were taking into account what they felt their own military plans required. But as they listened to advice from the Biden administration, one, they took it seriously. Two, they also began to think about, okay, how can we demonstrate that we're being responsive?
Health officials in Gaza say nearly 22,000 people have been killed in the region. This is NPR.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Lessons learned from a pilot program that aims to speed up replacement of lead pipes will be expanded to 200 communities nationwide. Now Wisconsin's largest city may take part. The Department of Natural Resources says it's been helping 10 communities apply for funding, identify lead pipes, and replace them, all as part of the pilot program. Now, Milwaukee Water Works says the city is applying to take part in the expanded effort. The water utilities superintendent says the city is interested in taking advantage of assistance related to community outreach. Robert Miranda with Get the Lead Out Coalition in Milwaukee says he'd like to see more community education for renters and homeowners.
The city should be providing information on precautionary measures for the community to take to ensure that they are safely removing this toxin from the water until they get their chance to do what they got to do for their homes.
Milwaukee Water Works says around 68,000 lead pipes still need to be replaced. People who shop in Milwaukee County, meanwhile, are paying a higher sales tax in 2024. Starting yesterday, the sales tax in the city of Milwaukee jumped up 2%, while the Milwaukee County sales tax added another 0.4%. That brings total sales taxes in 2024 to 7.9%. The Milwaukee Common Council and County Board approved the sales tax increases last year to help fund city services and an underfunded pension system. A deal with state lawmakers to increase shared revenue statewide allowed Milwaukee officials to approve the sales tax increases. Nearly half of the police department of a Waukesha County village resigned last week. Five members of the village of Big Bend department resigned last Thursday, according to WISN-TV. The chair of the village's fire and police commission also resigned. Big Bend's police chief died unexpectedly in October. The former fire and police commissioner chair says rather than bringing the community together, it fractured it further. There were three full-time and nine part-time officers on the department when the chief died. Now there are six officers and just one full-timer left. And one of the resigning officers says there will likely be more resignations. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing how people and communities can come together in polarizing times on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Philadelphia is set to make history today at the inauguration of its new mayor. Sherelle Parker will be the city's first female mayor and the fourth Black woman to run one of America's largest cities. WHYY reporter Carmen Russell Sluchansky joins us now from Philadelphia. Carmen, tell us more about Sherelle Parker.
Well, Parker came from a modest background, a fact that she made a central part of her campaign. In fact, here she is in her victory speech in November.
I didn't hide from it because I wouldn't allow anybody else to attempt to weaponize my humble beginnings against me. So before they could do it, I made sure that I told you that I was born to a single teenage mother, that I was raised by my grandparents, that my grandmother collected welfare and subsidized food to take care of me.
At 17, Parker won a speech contest, which caught the attention of a Philadelphia council member who took her on as an intern. After that, she briefly taught high school in New Jersey and returned to Philadelphia politics, going back to work for the city council. 10 years later, she became the youngest Black woman ever elected to the state legislature. Then in 2015, Parker ran for the city council and won.
How is Philadelphia reacting to having its first female mayor?
Well, there's certainly a lot of excitement. Philadelphia is a majority Black city, and the voter turnout was high in November. And the new administration is expecting about 3,500 people at the inauguration today, which will fill up the Metropolitan Opera House where it's being held.
You know, I spoke to Parker back in May after she won the Democratic primary and asked her about going against the more progressive wing of her party by pledging to hire hundreds of police officers and also bringing back so-called constitutional stop and frisk. Is she still committed to that as some of her top priorities?
You know, at the top of the list is gun violence, the top of the list of her priorities. Philadelphia is one of America's biggest cities, and it has growing rates of gun violence, homicides, and other violent crimes. So to counter this, Parker promised to add 300 police officers to a force of 6,000. And while she did call for an end to stop and frisk, she's also looking to replace them with stops that require police to have more evidence of a crime.
It is a legal tool. A crime must be committed, or they must know that it is going to be committed in order for them to have the just cause and reasonable suspicion to stop someone. They are called Terry stops.
So critics have said that this proposal isn't really that far from what police do now with stop and frisk. It really all comes down to how the police force implements the new policy. Parker will also need to weigh in on a controversial $1.5 billion proposal to build a new basketball stadium for the 76ers, currently slated to go in Chinatown, where residents are worried that their neighborhood's going to change a lot if that happens. Parker has yet to endorse or reject the project.
That's WHYY's Carmen Russell Sluchansky. Carmen, thanks.
Thank you.
European leaders have been asking how long they can really rely on the United States. Germany's defense minister has called upon European countries to do more for their own security in years to come. Former President Trump was notably close with Russia's leader and has shifted his party's views of Ukraine and European security. Our co-host, Leila Fadel, spoke with Dan Baer, who is director of the Europe Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It's certainly the case that many in Europe are very focused on the 2024 elections here and concerns about what a possible second Trump administration would mean for European security, given the former president's statements about withdrawing from NATO or reducing U.S. commitments to Europe. I think more pressingly, though, is the ongoing war, Russia's war against Ukraine, which has made clear that European security is not a done deal.
So let's break that down. Let's first talk about Russia and Ukraine. When we talk about this major security concern through the views of Europe, what does that look like?
Well, the reminder that there is a major land war, the largest land war since World War II in Europe, is a reminder that war is not done. I think more pressingly is the fact that there's a deep understanding that is emerging that if Russia is allowed to win in Ukraine, that won't be the end of the story. So Germany and others are recognizing that it's not what anybody wants to have an antagonistic relationship with Russia, mm-hmm. but they need to settle in for the long haul of recognizing that Russia will remain a major security threat to Europe for the foreseeable future.
How does that change if there's another Trump term?
Another Trump term will accelerate the need for the development of the European industrial base. And in some ways, part of the defense minister's comments were an intra-European sign, I guess, because the new government in Poland, headed by Donald Tusk, presents an opportunity. There's been a acrimonious relationship between Poland and Germany in recent years. And this is an opportunity. And I think the minister was sending a signal to Poland about the willingness to work together. And if the Weimar Triangle, which is Poland, France, and Germany, can work together on developing European security, they can be a powerful force.
I guess I want to get more focused, though, on Congress in the U.S. and the fact that aid for Ukraine is up in the air, that it's been delayed. I mean, what message has that sent to Europe?
Well, it sends a message to Europe in that the United States can't be relied upon to do what is in the United States' interest as well as in European interest. It also sends a message to the rest of the world, and I think that can't be underestimated. It's not only a failure that will make it more difficult for Ukraine to defend itself against Russian aggression, it's also a failure that makes the United States look weaker in the world, makes any potential partners question the value of our partnership. And so it is something that sets the United States back in our ability to build the kinds of partnerships that we need in the 21st century.
Why haven't European countries invested in defense and security capabilities in recent years? I mean, why are they in this position of playing catch up?
I think largely because of optimism about the progress of the European project. The European Union, the relative lack of conflict since World War II, has given European powers a sense of complacency. There was a longstanding belief in Germany that Russia could be a partner, not an adversary, and that the major strategic threat, therefore, that was obvious was not so much of a threat. And obviously, that has been proven wrong. So I think what we're seeing now is a need to renew a commitment to hard security and to investing in defense.
But there's also something kind of terrifying in what you just said, like a loss of faith that the threats are over, a possibility of another world war.
Well, I mean, I think you don't want the major powers of the world constantly jockeying for an upper hand, because that's the kind of situation that has in the past produced misunderstandings or conflagrations that result in large-scale wars. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also a way forward here. As the U.S. power relatively declines with the rise of other powers, there is a vacuum that is created, and Europe and other partners need to step up and fill that vacuum so that there are responsible security actors who are looking toward peace rather than looking toward the kind of contests and competition that result in conflict.
Dan Baer is the Senior Vice President for Policy Research and Director of the Europe Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. Glad you're along with us at 8:42 this morning. It's the 2nd of January. Still to come this hour here on the program. Lots more in this hour. We're going to hear a story out of Tampa. You know, we have covered a lot about PFAS here on this program and throughout the WPR news department. You can find a lot of that reporting at WPR.org. We'll hear about what Tampa is doing to combat those forever chemicals. That's on the way on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Explore how lasers can help combat cancer and how soil can lead to the discovery of new antibiotics in PBS Wisconsin Education's newest resource, Meet the Lab, an online collection of educational resources for middle school science classrooms, funded in part through the Timothy William Trout Education Fund. The full collection is available for free use by teachers, educators, and families at pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from Bethke Heating and Air Conditioning and the Beloit Janesville Symphony. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire. Convenient scheduling and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.
Radio at 8:44. Here's what's happening in news. Tsunami warnings across Japan have been lifted, but residents in many areas remain on alert for powerful aftershocks following a 7.6 magnitude earthquake that hit near Ishikawa yesterday. At least 48 people have been confirmed killed in that quake and following aftershocks. Meanwhile, five members of Japan's Coast Guard have died after a collision between a Coast Guard aircraft and a passenger plane on a runway in Tokyo today. All of the nearly 400 people on board that plane got out safely. The Israeli military is confirming that it's pulling thousands of troops out of the Gaza Strip. That could clear the way for a new long-term phase of lower-intensity fighting in the war. And a new report from the IZA Institute of Labor Economics estimates that about 1,500 more babies were born in Wisconsin as a result of the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from BritBox, with the goal of helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original series Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Early this year, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to officially set limits on six so-called forever chemicals, known as PFAS, in drinking water. One community that has seen elevated levels of two of these forever chemicals is Tampa, Florida. And now the city says it will likely be the first in the country to bring in a new technology that will make it easier to filter out these PFAS. Joining us now to tell us more about the city's plans is Jessica Mazaros with WUSF in Tampa. Jessica, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So could you just start by reminding us what PFAS chemicals are?
Sure. So PFAS actually stands for a large family of toxic man-made chemical compounds. They've been used in consumer and industry products since the 1940s, from clothing, upholstery, and carpet to microwave popcorn bags, pizza boxes, and even candy wrappers. They've been linked to negative health effects for people. Exposure to certain levels can impact the body's ability to fight infections and lead to reproductive effects or an increased risk of cancer. At this point, they are everywhere, so they end up in the water supply. Here's Sarah Burns with Tampa's Water Department.
We are passive receivers, so we don't generate a single drop of PFAS. It just comes to us in our source water.
The utility is actually part of a lawsuit against manufacturers of PFAS like 3M and DuPont to recover the cost of removal.
So tell us about this big new technology that Tampa is bringing in.
Yeah, the city of Tampa is getting the technology from the Netherlands. It's called SIX, or suspended ion exchange. It removes things like decaying vegetation from the water. And the city says to filter out PFAS, you have to first remove the organic matter. Tampa's water department would be the first in the country to have this system. The other two are in Europe. And the plan for this one is to filter 140 million gallons a day.
Can I ask, though, why is this needed? Is Tampa's water that bad?
Well, it's not that the water is bad. It's just that the city gets its drinking water from the Hillsborough River, which is collected along with all sorts of organic matter from nature. Now, Tampa did recently find slightly elevated levels of two of six PFAS in its drinking water supplies. The EPA proposed limit is at 4 parts per trillion for these two, and the highest the city found in its water was just over six.
This sounds expensive. How is this going to be paid for?
Well, Tampa is still in the designing phase, and the system won't be completed until about 2032. But Tampa's more than 700,000 water customers are already paying for it. It's expected to cost $200 million, and it's part of a larger infrastructure improvement plan that the city council already approved. So their water bills will be increasing every October until 2040. That said, city officials do point out that the technology will actually save the department nearly $1.5 million a year.
And how will it save that money?
Well, installing this SIX system means they'll use less chemicals and filters. Sarah Burns said if they weren't using this, they'd have to otherwise go through double the filters. Plus, getting the organic matter out of the water early on in the treatment process actually improves all the other stages that follow. So it makes the system a lot more efficient.
That's Jessica Mazaros with WUSF in Tampa. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. Glad you're with us. About 11 minutes left now in the program here, and we still have plenty more to get to. You know, as the calendar changed, we also hit a milestone in the past couple of months. The world population has now actually topped 8 billion, but the growth rate is reversing. It's actually slowing down. So what does this mean for the decades to come? We'll dive into that question in just a few minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to improving lives and strengthening nonprofits, and guiding donors like you toward tax-advantaged giving to make a positive impact on the community. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
Johnson, the state organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, it'll be the Michigan Wolverines taking on the Washington Huskies in the NCAA football championship next Monday. This after Michigan beat Alabama and Washington beat Texas yesterday. The Wisconsin Badgers ended up losing to the LSU Tigers in their bowl game yesterday. In the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Indiana Pacers last night. The Bucks will take on the Pacers again tomorrow night at 6. And the Green Bay Packers can make the NFL playoffs with the win over the Chicago Bears at home this weekend. That game will be played on Sunday and starts at 3:25 in the afternoon. In weather, mostly calm and cool across the state today. Mix of sunshine and clouds with high temperatures in the 20s and 30s. Light flurries in the northern part of the state overnight into tomorrow. That clears up by tomorrow afternoon with highs in the 20s and 30s once again. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. All right, look, a lot of people, actor and television host Mario Lopez, found himself on TikTok.
All right, today we're in Pacoima at Sabor a la Mexicana, and it means Mexican flavor.
Yeah, he was out eating food, and then he started trending on X, which got him a little worried that he might have said something that he shouldn't have. But it turns out it wasn't anything that he said as much as how he said it.
People don't think I'm Mexican. Is that a trip? With a name like Mario Lopez. You know what? They've been thinking I'm everything from Italian to Hawaiian, but I'm not. That's the weirdest thing.
Lopez was born in Chula Vista in Southern California. That's north of the U.S. border with Mexico. His parents are both from Mexico. And while these facts are right there in his Wikipedia page, it seemed to be a revelation for lots of people when Lopez, came out as Mexican. Mario, why was it important to make it clear that you indeed have Mexican heritage?
The whole thing was so bizarre and weird. I mean, I have a Z in my last name. And like the thing about social media is it allows you to kind of take a peek behind the curtain, and it's unfiltered, and you represent yourself how you really are. At least with me, that's the case. I mean, I can't talk the way I do to like my buddies and my guys from the neighborhood when I'm hosting my radio show or Access Hollywood. I think everyone has like their customer service voice to kind of slip into. But when I'm not, then I'm with my buddies and I'm a little more slang and it's a little more relaxed and probably my ethnicity comes out a little more.
Were you perplexed, angry, annoyed, all of the above over all this?
I thought it was just funny and kind of silly. I didn't understand it, but I guess people weren't used to seeing me sort of just be myself and with my buddies. But again, that's one of the, I think, the cool things about social media. You kind of put out there your real self, kind of raw.
Yeah. And there's a term for that called code switching. I mean, is that something that you've consciously done over the years to kind of just stay employed in Hollywood? Or is that something that kind of just comes out depending on the situation when it calls for it?
Yeah, I got hip to the term code switching. And you try to be a little bit more buttoned up in certain scenarios, and especially when I'm on TV and representing NBC Universal and we're on the news division, then you got to be a little bit more buttoned up and polished.
In researching the reaction to this, Mario, I went down a TikTok rabbit hole on you, and there was one clip in particular that kind of struck me. It's where your Latinness, so to speak, was questioned. Let's hear that clip real quick.
This man is whitewashed, and he's literally only been doing this Mexican thing for like 3 or 4 years.
I mean, what does it make you feel when you hear something like that?
It's so stupid. My parents are from Culiacán, Sinaloa in Mexico. I was born in Chula Vista, border town, around all Latinos. But, you know, people can think of like what they want. What does bother me is you don't have to sound like an ignorant paisa or somebody that's just across the border to claim your Mexican Latin card. You can sound above average intelligence and be able to hold a conversation, and you talk differently. I talk differently around my mom than I do my buddies. I talk differently at work than I do when I'm around my guys at the gym. You just talk differently. And has nothing to do with my culture, which I proudly represent all the time.
You're one of the stars of an NBC sitcom called Saved by the Bell. There's a whole generation of people that love that show. And on that show, your character's name was A.C. Slater, which, if I recall, was not intended for a Latino to play. But you had a great audition and you got the role. And I'm wondering, Mario, if that could have been maybe the starting point for why so many people maybe think that your Latinidad, so to speak, was somehow lost.
I was fortunate enough for that role and a bunch of other roles. The casting directors sort of casted blindly. And I think the role of the guy was supposed to be Italian, and it was great. And I thought it was cool. You shouldn't be just sort of necessarily typecast just because of an ethnicity. And I'm, you know, 100% Mexican. So I thought that was cool. But going back to that guy's point, you know, again, social media, it's sort of like your own little reality show, right? So then you're not playing a character, you're not hosting, it's just you. And so then that's why people are maybe tripping out a little bit.
If NBC like sat you down, Mario, and said, hey, you know what? We just want you to be you now. I mean, you just be you like you are in these videos.
That is me. That is me. I wouldn't feel comfortable.
Actually, on Access Hollywood, though.
I wouldn't feel comfortable like that, because I wouldn't want to represent myself like that on TV.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't want my kids. I'd watch that. If it were my son, I'd be like, hey, keep it buttoned up.
All right. That's Mario Lopez, host of Access Hollywood. And yes, a confirmed Mexican. Mario, thanks a lot for joining us.
You got it, man. Appreciate it.
We have some news about the year that just ended. The world's population grew by more than 75 million people last year.
Now, that sounds like a lot, but the pace of growth is slowing.
We know that the global population is likely to even out in the coming decades and then potentially even to start to decline.
Rachel Franklin at Newcastle University in England studies trends among the 8 billion people now sharing this planet. She sees hints of our future in a country that has an aging population and a declining birth rate.
What's happening in Japan is what's going to happen in lots of countries around the world in the coming decades. At least for a few decades, we'll have a lot of older people supported by sort of a narrower foundation of those who are in the labor force.
As countries become more prosperous, their birth rates tend to drop.
Many countries already produce fewer than the 2.1 babies that we generally say are required in order to maintain a population size.
Now, in theory, a smaller population could be easier to manage. Fewer people might consume fewer resources and contribute less to climate change. But we can't really count on slower population growth to take care of that problem.
So we could have fewer people in the world, but if their living standards increase at the pace that our living standards did for the past 100 years, we're still going to see a huge environmental impact.
William Fry is a demographer at the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank. He says that in the U.S., immigration will determine future population trends.
Just from a demographic standpoint, this country is very much dependent on immigration in the future to have sustainable growth.
So in a time of declining birth rates, it matters a lot where people prefer to move.
It's hard to know what fertility preferences may look like in a couple of decades. We don't know if younger generations may prefer to move more, and we don't know if we'll decide to increase the numbers of people that we admit into this country.
And for this new year that is just getting started, the U.S. population is expected to grow by one person about every 24 seconds. That is taking into account birth, deaths, and international migration. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for spending the first Tuesday of 2024 with us, and thanks to John Davis for helping to bring us the news each and every weekday morning. That news is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from the St. Norbert College and Community Shares of Wisconsin. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, El